wherever we go, the Alaskans are treated in a way of, boy, we heard about the Palin, we think that's great.
Alaska delegates attend the Republican National Convention amid a swirl of news about Governor Palin. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 2nd of September. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, how one of this summer's volcanic eruptions remade an island.
It's just incredibly large as far as the amount of change and whole sections of the mountain blown out and stuff.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Attorneys for Senator Ted Stevens say the FBI recorded more than 100 of the Republican lawmakers' phone conversations. Jurors could hear those calls later this month when Stevens stands trial on charges of lying about hundreds of thousands of dollars in home renovations and other gifts he received from an oil contractor. The FBI did not tap Stevens' phone, but did tap several phones belonging to contractors in the case. Stevens was recorded 105 times. In court documents filed today, Stevens' attorneys say they may try to keep jurors from ever hearing those phone conversations. They say the FBI may have inappropriately taped those calls if they were outside the scope of the government's warrant. The Republican National Convention got into full swing in St. Paul, Minnesota today after being largely on hold yesterday as Hurricane Gustav hit Louisiana. President George Bush was scheduled to address delegates by video link-up. Former Senator Fred Thompson and Independent Senator Joe Lieberman were also in the lineup. But the big news continues to be Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, John McCain's running mate. McCain says he's satisfied that Palin's background was properly checked out before she joined the Republican ticket. He told reporters that the vetting process was completely thorough. But questions about the review have surfaced in the last few days. Michael Carey, host of KAKM's Anchorage Edition, is at the convention. He says so far, convention business has been slow.
There's a sense that there's not much going on right at the moment, although I think the press is very active in searching out for who is Sarah Palin, and there's a tremendous amount of time and effort and hundreds of people working on that story. It's unbelievable. Here, if you open a newspaper, pick up Newsweek magazine, turn on the television, there she is.
And Michael, what do you know about Governor Palin's schedule at this point?
My understanding is that she doesn't have a schedule, that she's in a hotel. She was supposed to get an award today or speak to a Right to Life group. That was canceled. The media was told that she's working on her speech. There are those who feel the obvious that, or would come to a conclusion that they think is obvious, that she's being kept from the press for some campaign reason.
Has she made any appearances?
Not in Minneapolis-St. Paul.
And have you heard any worries that all the Palin news has been a distraction from the main business of the convention?
It's a cliche, many people have said it, but it's really slowed the momentum for the Republicans. There's no question about it. And they don't seem to have been prepared. It really is very odd. I ran into a press conference yesterday where Steve Schmidt, one of the big leaders of the McCain campaign, was surrounded by around 40 reporters who were just beating him over the head with this question of essentially what did John McCain know and when did he know it about the pregnancy. And for those who don't know it, Mr. Johnston, the young hockey player, wound up on the front page of New York's two biggest tabloids today, the New York Post and the New York Daily News.
What types of questions have you heard from others at the convention and about Alaska? Is this generally sparking a lot of interest in the state?
Yeah, and it's sparking a lot of tourism, too. There are a number of reporters who've flown up there to go out to Wasilla and ask questions. In fact, I've been getting a lot of questions about what is Wasilla? What kind of place is it? Is it suburban, as we know, here in the Twin Cities or in the east? Is it kind of a western suburb, or is it some kind of village of the damned, a really strange place that produces funny hockey players and women who somehow wind up as vice president?
Have you heard anyone talk about, are they concerned there at the convention that this latest media blitz surrounding Palin will go help them in the long run, or that it may hurt them?
This is Spin Central, and a number of you'd get spin at the Democratic convention, but here at the Republican convention, you're getting a lot of it about how this is going to help the Republicans because it humanizes Sarah Palin and makes her look like people down the road, the other mom. I even heard one guy on television have the nerve to say, I mean, he sort of suggested, I'm white trash. Lots of people understand white trash, as if maybe Sarah Palin and her family were. It's a very strange kind of argument, but this is the ultimate, I guess, in making lemonade out of lemons.
Michael Carey is host of KAKM's Anchorage Edition. He's covering the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota. 29 Alaskans are attending the convention in St. Paul. Former state legislator Nick Stepovich of Fairbanks is one of them. Stepovich says the selection of Sarah Palin has made quite a splash at the convention.
Every delegation, people through the bars and all the stores and wherever we go, the Alaskans are treated in a way of, boy, we heard about Palin. We think that's great. We're getting a heads up everywhere on that.
Stepovich says he's heard little negative feedback in response to the ongoing investigation into Governor Palin's firing of the state's public safety commissioner in July and news yesterday of her daughter's pregnancy.
When something like that happens in anybody's family, it's a blessing, not a burden. She and her family are going to handle that, and they're going to handle it the right way.
Stepovich says the Palin selection has generated record donations and large crowds for the McCain campaign over the last few days. He says Palin's candidacy changes everything about the convention experience for Alaska's delegates.
Our seats will probably be better, it's jokingly said, but that's true. I bet they'll move us closer to the podium. But this spotlights Alaska. You know, for years and years, Alaska has been perceived in many ways from the lower 48, but now they'll get a more realistic view of what we as Alaskans hold dear and what we need and what we offer the United States as well.
Stepovich says as the Alaska delegation's whip, he's working with State Party Chairman Chris Nelson of Anchorage to ensure members unanimously support the McCain-Palin nomination. Kim Skipper is a delegate from Anchorage. She says she's thrilled about the attention Palin's nomination will mean for the state.
I think it's a great thing for the state of Alaska. It's put us on the map, it lends some credence for the issues that we have, the energy issue in the United States right now. It puts Alaska front and center on that debate, and I think it could not be anything but good news for Alaska.
Bill Knoll is an Anchorage resident who is a convention delegate for the first time. He says even though John McCain has long been against opening ANWR to oil drilling, Governor Palin will have a great platform for pushing the issue.
She is very well known in her opinions on that subject, and she's not making it sound like it's for Alaska, but rather for America. She's speaking in terms of more oil independence. No, I think she can be very convincing.
Knoll says he's heard news networks across the country speculate that Palin isn't ready to be so close to the presidency, but he doesn't buy it.
That is an argument of last recourse. But you know what? She has got small town America written all over her. She is a hockey mom, self-described. She's got a family. She's been, as they say, a chief executive of a small town. It's wonderful. The kind of contact you can make with real people at that level is refreshing, and it is exactly what America needs.
Governor Palin is scheduled to address the convention to accept her nomination tomorrow night. When she ran for governor in 2006, Palin received broad support from the state's fishing industry. She touted herself as a commercial fisherman, having worked at her family's set net site in Bristol Bay. But reaction from Alaska fishermen to her new role on the Republican ticket has been mixed. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
United Fishermen of Alaska Executive Director Mark Vinsel was in Palmer for the state fair when he heard the news about Palin becoming John McCain's running mate. Vinsel and the governor were scheduled to appear together at the unveiling of the new U.S. quarter featuring an Alaska design with a grizzly bear eating a salmon. Despite concerns about Palin's relative youth and inexperience, Vinsel says he thinks she can bring issues important to Alaska fishermen to the national spotlight. One area in particular that he says needs more attention is federal funding for research projects that support sustainable fisheries.
with the negative attention on earmarks, it's not all that well known, but the a lot of the science, the federally funded science of NOAA's budget has often been done almost completely with earmarks because in general, Alaska's congressional delegation usually knew better than NOAA administrators in Washington as to what needed to be done up here to ensure the sustainability of our fisheries.
But not everyone in the fishing industry thinks that Palin is a good choice to be vice president. Kodiak City Councilman Terry Haynes is a fisherman and a member of the grassroots advocacy group Crewman's Association.
Governor Palin is needed here in Alaska. And I was very, very disappointed to hear that she's ready to leave all the jobs that she has going here to pursue a job I don't think she's really qualified for yet.
Haynes says Palin has been a strong advocate for working fishermen, but he's not convinced that she could help Alaska's fishing industry as vice president.
I think a strong, fresh candidate for a representative in our Senate would do a better job at that. The vice president has a hard time advocating specific issues like that.
Many fishermen supported Palin's run for governor 2 years ago after growing disillusioned with the policies of former governors Frank Murkowski and Tony Knowles. However, Palin recently angered some in the industry when she came out against ballot measure 4, the so-called Clean Water Initiative, which was aimed at regulating the toxic discharge of large-scale mining operations like the proposed Pebble Mine at the headwaters of Bristol Bay's sockeye salmon fishery. In Kodiak, I'm Casey Kelly.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, assessing the impact of statehood on Alaska Natives.
Over the past 50 years, we've had a very interesting relationship with the state. As members of the state, who have just often gone unheard.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by Tech Cominco and the Red Dog Mine, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
When Kasatoshi volcano erupted last month, it did more than release massive clouds of ash and sulfur. It remade the face of the island. KIAL's Ann Hillman has the story.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist Jeff Williams circled Kasatoshi Volcano in the service's research vessel. The lush green island he had stationed researchers on for the past 13 years had become a large gray mass.
I mean, it's huge how much it's changed. It's just incredibly large as far as the amount of change and whole sections of the mountain blown out and stuff. So I'm very glad that we got them off there.
The August 7th eruption forced the sudden and successful evacuation of two fish and wildlife technicians who were monitoring birds on the island. Williams says without the warnings and information from the Alaska Volcano Observatory and without ADAC fisherman Al Giddens' willingness to go to the island on a moment's notice, the technicians wouldn't have survived. Everything on the island was destroyed. The island used to be home to 100,000 nesting auklets, thousands of puffins and storm petrels, and hundreds of gulls. William says many of them may have survived and left the area.
The nice thing about being in a bird on a volcanic island, if it does erupt, you can just fly away. But if you're a chick inside a burrow or a crevice or on a nest, you're not going to get away. So those ones probably perished, I would think.
He says the adults may come back to the area to breed next year, but will have to nest on different islands. Kasatoshi was also home to one of the largest sea lion rookeries in the Central Aleutians. About half of the group has already returned, although Williams couldn't see any pups with them.
That's an interesting thing to see how that life can, you know, come again to that island. And it already is there. It's remarkable how resilient life is. Like you say, we had sea lions on the beach. Not at the place where they were formerly breeding at the rookery, but at other locations. We had gulls there, we had some puffins, we had raven there. So there's things happening there. But I think it's going to be a while before things come back significantly.
Botanists estimate it will take 20 to 50 years for plants to repopulate the island. AVO scientist Chris Way Thomas explains that the island is now covered with several meters of pyroclastic flow, or larger rocks and boulders. And that is sheathed in pyroclastic surge.
Like mud, right? Yeah. That's what's all over the surface. It's very soft and sticky, very fine grained. If it's in some places, it's wet and like quicksand almost.
He says during the 14-hour eruption, the material moved between 60 to 100 miles per hour over different portions of the island. Kasatochi's eruption was significantly more explosive than those of Okmok and Cleveland. Wei Thomas theorizes this is because of the amount of time since its last eruption. He says the magma sat beneath Kasatochi for at least 100 years, giving it time to separate into layers. The lightweight explosive silica rose to the top. When the volcano began to erupt, the volatile silica mixed with the lakes in the caldera, creating three massive explosions. The first two only produced gas. The magma under Okmok and Cleveland didn't have the time to settle because they erupt so frequently. That means their ash has different, less explosive compositions, and their eruptions are smaller. Kasatochi's eruption was so strong, it even triggered a small tsunami.
That's one of only a handful of modern examples of pyroclastic flows going into the sea and initiating a tsunami.
But by the time it reached Adak, it was only 20 centimeters high. Waves hitting Kasatochi itself have already begun eroding the new beaches and recreating its coastline. In Adak, I'm Ann Hillman.
State regulators last week declined to adopt the Bush administration's system for allowing people who generate their own electricity to sell it back into the grid. But some sort of system is mandated by federal law, so the Regulatory Commission of Alaska will now have to come up with a system of its own. For member station KBBI, Mike Mason reports.
Net metering is the practice of allowing people to put in place their own electricity generation capacity and to basically put any excess energy back onto the main electricity grid. Proponents of the concept contend that allowing net metering will lower utility bills and encourage customers to install alternative energy generating equipment, which in turn could eliminate the need for utilities to install additional generation capacity. Opponents of the idea contend that net metering will result in non-generating customers subsidizing the activities and investments of customers who generate electricity. On Wednesday, the RCA published their ruling to not adopt the federal net metering standard. This decision disappoints Homer area resident Mike O'Meara, who's part of an ad hoc group called the HEA Members Forum.
I think all of those people, and there were many, many proponents of adopting the federal net metering guidelines are disappointed. It's not the end of the line, however, and there was considerable discussion about this whole thing among the various members of the RCA. They will now set up a new docket in order to take a look at net metering. But net metering based upon what they feel would be a more appropriate set of standards for Alaska. And so I think what needs to be done now is that the proponents of net metering need to encourage the RCA to do that as quickly as possible and to proceed as quickly as possible.
The Regulatory Commission of Alaska was required to consider adopting the new standard as part of the Energy Policy Act of 2005. The federal standard stipulated that each electric utility shall make available upon request net metering service to any electric customer. While the RCA rejected the federal standard, they agreed to open a new docket to address a state-specific net metering requirement. The RCA specifically noted that they intend to combine consideration of net metering with the adoption of interconnection standards. In the ruling published on Wednesday, the RCA also declined to put in place the federal fuel diversity standard to minimize dependence on one fuel source. They also rejected the federal fossil fuel generation efficiency standard that called on electric utilities to develop and implement a 10-year plan to increase the efficiency of its fossil fuel generation. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888, the number 4, and then Alaska.
Petersburg's airport is set to shut down for up to a month this spring. That will mean passengers and freight will have to travel to and from Wrangell to catch Alaska Airlines flights. It's part of a major project to reconstruct the runway with new safety improvements. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The project involves an increase in the safety zone surrounding the runway, as well as the replacement and repair of water culverts running underneath. Jim Heumann is engineering manager with the Alaska Department of Transportation.
It's pretty consistent with what we are just about completing at the Wrangell Airport, and we're also near completion of the Ketchikan Airport. And it's basically a program to bring our jet airport facilities in conformance with current FAA standards.
The contractor is Kiewit Pacific Company of Anchorage. The work is expected to take a year to complete at a cost of around $20 million.
Well, the Phase 1 improvements focuses on the first stage of upgrading the runway safety area for the airport, and it will primarily include the replacement of cross-runway culverts across the existing runway and widening the runway safety area along either side of it.
For part of that culvert replacement work, the DOT will shut down the runway for up to a month, starting March 23rd of next year. The runway is expected to reopen no later than April 21st, but the closure will substantially complicate travel in and out of Petersburg. Heumann says the DOT will provide bus and ferry service to and from Wrangell for each of the town's two scheduled Alaska Airlines flights.
Yes, the alternate transportation plan will basically pick people up at the Petersburg Airport and convey them to Wrangell via the Mitkov Highway and the inter-island ferry Stikine, and it will go back and forth twice a day.
Airline passengers traveling to Petersburg will land in Wrangell, take the return ferry, and then a bus back to town. Flying out of Petersburg during that closure will mean getting to the airport a lot earlier than usual. Dave Berg is owner of Viking Travel in Petersburg. He says passengers will probably need to check in 3 to 4 hours before a flight during the closure.
There'll be quite a bit of extra travel involved just getting on the jet and getting to and from the jet, because all the departures from Petersburg will be leaving from Wrangell, of course. It won't involve any changes of ticketing. We'll still have tickets out of Petersburg. But the check-in process will change dramatically. I am recommending that people just avoid traveling at that point.
The state is also making accommodations for emergency medevacs during that time with the help of the Coast Guard, according to Berg, who is also an emergency medical technician in Petersburg and spokesman for the local volunteer fire department. He says the department is coordinating with the state and the Coast Guard to plan for emergencies during the closure.
You know, at the time that the runway is going to be closed, the Coast Guard will be providing transportation in their helicopter, probably depending upon where the patient will have to go or is coming from, probably from Wrangell. And then the medevac jet will land at the Wrangell Airport, and the Coast Guard will deliver to the Wrangell Airport, and then the medevac will take place from there.
Then there's cargo, always a concern for seafood shippers and others trying to get perishables or other express shipping items in and out of Petersburg on the airplane. The state's Jim Heumann says the project will provide transportation services for air cargo similar to the passenger transportation. Petersburg area businessman Dave Kensinger says he just hopes the state can keep the closure short, because combined with limited state ferry service, things will be difficult over the winter and spring for frequent travelers in and out of Petersburg.
For 6 weeks, we only have one northbound ferry on Sunday night and a southbound, the Bellingham ferry that comes through on Wednesday. So that's our only ferry transportation, and right when we get done with that, then we're not going to have any plane transportation that's going to be very easy to use in and out of town, and it makes it really hard for people to get in and out of town and to conduct business. I think it's kind of a double whammy there.
For more information and updates on the airport project, you can visit the Department of Transportation's website at dot.alaska.gov/Petersburg-airport. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The First Alaskans Institute, an Alaska Native advocacy organization, is holding a series of statewide discussions on the impacts of statehood to Alaska Native people. The forums will be held in several communities over the next 2 months with the goal of providing a relaxed atmosphere for a discussion about how statehood has affected the lives of Alaska's First People. Liz Cheney is the director of the Institute's Native Policy Center. She says the effort is to allow an unscripted conversation about what statehood means to individuals Alaska Natives.
Over the past 50 years, we've had a very interesting relationship with the state. As members of the state who have very important, important things to say, but have just often gone unheard, this is a really great time to do that, you know, as Alaska's reflecting on how it's been the last 50 years.
And what will the format of the discussions be? What's the setup going to amount to? Okay.
We are going to have three discussion leaders. Byron Malott, who is Tlingit, and he is our tradition bearer and will be providing an Alaska Native perspective. Vic Fisher, who is an honorary scholar, and he will be providing his perspective as a delegate to the Alaska Constitutional Convention. And then myself, I'm the director of the Policy Center, and I will be providing the perspective from a younger Alaska Native's view. And it will also be webcast on firstalaskans.org for those who are interested but can't join us, especially folks out in rural Alaska.
And will this webcast be a two-way discussion? Will communities who log in be able to interact?
Well, I'm not too sure about that right now, actually. That's something we're still working on. We're trying to create a web blog so that people out in rural Alaska or others who just couldn't make it to the forum can watch the webcast, and when they have questions, just send them right up to us. But those details haven't been worked out yet. So we're hoping, and people can check back at the website to find out details about it.
What are you hoping to learn from having these statewide discussions with Alaska Native people?
The intent, at least for the Policy Center, is that we provide the forum and we facilitate the discussion because it has to be had. It hasn't up to this point. And really what we're hoping for is that people come out, participate, and really share the impacts that they have felt in their own life or perhaps in their villages, in their tribes, just in rural Alaska and urban Alaska, and from one Alaska Native to other Alaska Natives. I'm really curious to hear how other people have been impacted or how they feel about their state of Alaska.
Liz Cheney is the Alaska Native Policy Center Director for the First Alaskans Institute. The first discussion is going on this evening until 9 p.m. at the Morris K. Thompson Center in Fairbanks. Tomorrow, the meeting will take place at the Inupiaq Heritage Center in Barrow. Bethel will host a gathering on September 20th, and another is planned on October 22nd during the Alaska Native Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage. More information is available online. Look for the link on our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Michael Carey in St. Paul, Minnesota, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Kodiak, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Mike Mason in Homer, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Also thanks to Pippa Escalante in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Profit is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.